Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your every Monday dose of libertarian caterwauling at the news. I am Matt Welch, joined by Peter Suderman, Catherine Mangy Ward, and special guest star, Christian Bridgeke. Please clap, and hello, everyone.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hello.
this poor timid mouse.
That's not the real Christian, as the listeners will soon relearn.
Yeah, he's wearing a Motorhead shirt and talking about reading Crime and Punishment, so he's having a solid winter. We're going to take a January 10th look back at the 1 year anniversary of January 6th here in a moment. But first, I'd like to introduce y'all to a new podcast. It's called The Long Time Academy, that rare podcast that's exactly what the title says it is. It's about time. It's about how we think about time and how we should maybe train ourselves to think more long term. Some actual like lessons and exercises to help reorient your noggin towards that task. Its aim is to deep inhale for all of us to be a good ancestor. Yeah, that's right. You'll hear from people like, obviously enough, Brian Eno, Celeste Headlee, George the Poet, Jay Griffiths, and Alua Arthur. Live life better by confronting your own mortality, Catherine. Get off the treadmill of short-term thinking. It's about the absolute horizon, man. Search for the Longtime Academy anywhere you listen to podcasts. Life is short. Time is long. The Longtime Academy. Download it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, last week was weird. There was some kind of attempt in Washington, D.C. and on the failing cable news to make January 6th some kind of awful new holiday to memorialize the events of the Jan 6, 2021 nerve-rattling riot by pro-Trump trespassers in the Capitol building on V-Day that Joe Biden was scheduled to be certified as the winner of the 2020 election. Then President Trump, after 2 months of pressuring Congress and his own vice president to quote-unquote stop the steal, even though the court, every court who had looked at it, had swatted away his legal team's conspiracy theories, he had just prior to the riot implored his supporters to fight like hell and go over to the Capitol. They did, and now a whole bunch of them are facing prison sentences. Catherine, you are an Inside the Beltway gal. What was Thursday like? And then also, and we'll go around the round table here for each of us. What is the single thing that is related in any way to January 6th, 2021 worries you the most going forward? Catherine?
I definitely had a pretty strong reaction to January 6th when it happened originally. I could hear a little bit of it downstream, like people were coming up my street from the rally. It felt kind of scary. And certainly the idea of a group of people, albeit a near comically disorganized group of people, trying to stop the general progress of certifying a free and fair election was something that I took very seriously. And as you say, as kind of a hometown girl, didn't like it happening in my backyard. I will say, it seems to me that with the distance of a year, I am less worried about what January 6th means. And I think it's interesting that the Washington Post and associated entities decided to be even more upset about what January 6th means at the anniversary. There was basically a full week of coverage in the local paper here about January 6th and the threat to democracy and the peril and the this and the that. We can talk a little bit about some of the criminal justice aspects and civil liberties aspects, which I think are interesting. But I will say the distance of a year has made me less panicked about what happened there, not more.
Suderman, have you devised a democracy in peril cocktail for the occasion? And is that wobbling your knees, or what are you worried about that has to do with January 6th?
So just like cocktails, my answer has multiple parts that are going to work together into a seamless whole.
Is the ratio 5-3-3 or
we're going to get there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to step on the cocktail joke.
It's what I worry about in the aftermath of January 6th is not just one thing. It's a constellation of things that all add up to one thing. So I worry about January 6th-like events happening again, but I don't mean just something that is a replica of a riot at the Capitol. I mean, truly weird kind of mob chaos that is politically oriented, right? And in particular, I worry about small groups of kind of fringe actors, not overthrowing the government or ending democracy, you know, as we know it, but causing moderate levels of terror and chaos in a way that like they don't even necessarily plan. Because I think January 6th, while it wasn't that there was no intention going in, the thing that happened was not something that was meticulously planned, right? It was just sort of, it was semi-spontaneous, even though everybody was sort of there for, there to cause some sort of chaos. But then and then relatedly, I worry about the encouragement that folks on the right in particular are getting from Republicans who have decided that some combination of fealty to both Trump and the notion that the 2020 election was stolen or is illegitimate has now become a litmus test for holding party office. And I worry about all the downstream consequences of a party that has decided that loyalty to a particular person and also relatedly to a lie about that person's political fortunes is an essential part of their political identity. But then on the flip side, I worry about Democrats who have decided to insist that if you think Republicans are worryingly wrong about the legitimacy of the 2020 election and what happened there, you must support not only all Democratic politicians, but the entire progressive agenda from the Green New Deal to Medicare for All to all the rest of it. And relatedly, Democrats who I think are readying themselves in ways that have been largely undiscussed to use Republican intransigence on Trump and 2020 to deny or undermine election results in other ways that we haven't talked about yet. So it's not any one single thing. It's the entire kind of destabilizing political dynamic that is probably not going to produce more exact, precise replicas of January 6th, but that might produce events that are similarly chaotic and crazy-making and divisive just in terms of, not in just in terms of what they do, but in terms of how they are understood politically and by voters.
Christian, you're wearing a Motorhead shirt. Were there, first of all, any Motorhead shirts January 6th in your recollection? Second of all, what would Lemmy do in a riot? And then just generally, what, if anything, are you kind of worried about that's Jan 6 related?
Yeah, sure. A lot of big questions. I did not see any Motorhead t-shirts, but I do believe there was a member of, I don't know if this is libelous if I get the band name wrong, but Brutal Truth, Iced Truth.
Ooh, Brutal Truth is a good band
Damon
name
Rude
to bring
band?
To like an election truther riot.
Sure, absolutely. But now they're one member short because he was unfortunately in the Capitol. So the thing that, to your question about what Lemmy would do, I think he's not really a joiner, so I don't think he would have participated in the riot, but I don't think he would have been too disturbed by the mob violence either. And that's kind of, I guess that is kind of my position as well. I find it kind of disturbing, but also a little amusing that I feel like the real villains of January 6th haven't really faced many consequences. You know, like the really bad things that was happening that day were these congressional shenanigans encouraged by Trump, encouraged by some of his legal advisors to, you know, effectively try and delay or steal an election. And they, you know, these folks, they generally haven't played any sort of political consequences for that. Trump's favorability numbers among Republicans are pretty constant. Meanwhile, the kind of like idiot foot soldiers that they encourage to do, you know, these things, you know, some of whom committed violent crimes, some of whom didn't, are facing the full brunt of the security state, which will probably expand and has kind of expanded in the wake of January 6th. So that's kind of what worries me the most.
I do want to note, I just did a quick Google so that we can avoid all going to jail for Christian. Mm. And it seems that the band's name is Iced Earth.
Ah, Little okay. Truth.
Which is also, Iced you know, Earth. Like, they really probably should have, like, more of a climate protest or something. Like,
well, there was those climate protesters that pushed their way into the Interior Department. Where was he there? Where, I guess probably in prison,
honestly,
right?
Yeah. It was too late already.
As a someone who consumed a lot of Democracy in Peril journalism last week, I was shocked by how little my initial worry about all of this, much of which overlaps with what Peter was saying, but my very specific worry about this was what Christian was saying. It's the 139 members of the House of Representatives and the eight senators, all from the Republican Party, who at some point during that day where they were ransacked by a mob, voted to delay or to not certify the election, that people would do that. We've seen this in the past, smaller numbers of Democrats at various points in the 21st century, especially, have voted against certification, but it's much smaller numbers, and that there hasn't been a big political prize. I find it very kind of grating to see the way that the word "the big lie" is being forced upon everyone. As the AP style guide, you cannot refer to stop the steal thing as anything else except the big lie, and to make everyone answer for it. There's something kind of annoying about that, but that could just be my irritation in general. But the actual reality of sitting Republican office holders voting against certifying the election, and then now seemingly the party is more listing more in that direction than it was before. So if you have a majority of the party, which is true, who believes that the election was somehow illegitimate, rigged, or stolen, they're going to incentivize not just the office holders, but the election officials going forward, which is the other piece of a thing to worry about. Catherine, you talked about the criminal justice aspect of it. Do you perceive an overly heavy hand, or I think are people being made an example of who've been arrested and are some of them in some cases sentenced for, you know, multi-year prison terms for not actually committing any acts of violence?
Yeah, I will say similar actually to my broader reaction. I was pretty worried that there would be a law enforcement backlash that would kick in very quickly post January 6th. I thought that we would get people on the no-fly list right away. I thought that we would have, you know, there was this sort of cutesy thing that happened where all the DC liberal ladies changed their dating app profiles to say they were conservative, and then like catfished conservatives who were on Capitol Hill on January 6th, and then reported them to the FBI. And I was like, that's hilarious and adorable and a really not actually great for society. Like, that's not the world we really want
to be
living in.
To be clear, you object to the dating apps?
I object to all of it, frankly, but the idea of this, like, cute, you know, like be a narc but make it cute is like not where I really want to live. But and I will say that some of the sentences, in my view, have been too harsh. I think it's a difficult question though, because this was both an example of like a very, very serious thing, and each individual person was like at best kind of a jackass, with the exception, of course, of the actual shooting that occurred in the Capitol. But, you know, most of the people who have been arrested were, you know, they like took a dumb souvenir and then left, or they disordered a bunch of papers and then left, or they for some reason were wearing a Viking hat and no shirt and then left. And I think there's a legitimate question about what those sentences should be. I think overall in the United States, basically everyone's sentence is too harsh, and this is an example of that. I definitely enjoyed a little, I don't know, it's not Schadenfreude exactly, but conservatives discovering that people accused of crimes get treated badly while they await trial was like a, hey, oh, welcome to the party. Don't think that's going to produce lasting change.
No, it's not. Peter, you want to tease out what you referenced at the end of your cocktail mix of an answer, which is the way in which I think you said Democrats are using this to question results of election. Did I get that right?
So not are using, but I think sort of sub rosa, if you follow progressive activist politics. And I will be clear, I don't think this has risen to the level, certainly not of Democratic leadership, but even of members of Congress are not talking about this certainly in any way that's explicit or that you can pin down in a quote, anything like that. And so maybe I'm overreacting here, but I do think there is some movement on the left to try to basically say that because Republicans are going to play electoral process hardball, or to say because Republicans are going to use illegitimate means to try to win elections, I think maybe that's the even clearer excuse, we've got to play electoral process hardball in return. And that may mean simply saying that we don't accept the results of elections that we think went the wrong way, because in a way that they that might not have been true 10 or 20 years ago, right? And that there is going to be increased haggling, let's say, at minimum, over election results, and perhaps some sort of, I think, dangerous wading into refusing to accept results that are legitimate when they are very, very, very close. And I just don't relish that happening. I think that's going to be a bad turn.
I mean, when
it's already a bad turn, and it's, I think it's potentially going to get worse.
It's interesting that sometimes in the same breath of people, and by people in this case, I mean the Washington Post media columnist Margaret Sullivan, imploring everybody in the media to just, you know, hit the gong on a daily basis, saying democracy is in peril every day, every hour. And then saying in the same breath that Stacey Abrams is a hero, the 2018 gubernatorial loser in Georgia, super tight election, very, very close, very disputed and controversial. She's never conceded that election. She's, you know, she's had to accept the results, but she's never said I lost. And to be held up as a hero in the same breath of like, hey, look, what about our norms? This is all very important. The other thing that's
I think for Democrats, the next time a Democrat loses an election by an extremely close margin and the recount says, well, yeah, you still lost it, you know, you go through the process, there is going to be significant pressure from Democratic activists to not concede.
Well, and this is also, you know, this gets to, if I had to say kind of a broader, like, what is a January 6th fallout thing that you are worried about? You know, we've talked on this podcast about the increase in polarization generally, and I am always specifically alarmed by these polls that find basically an increasing sentiment in both parties that the other party is now so far beyond the pale that their shittiness justifies process violations to prevent them from winning. Like, that sounds like a very specific thing, but we have like actually some decent longitudinal polling data on that question. And that sentiment is dramatically on the rise. And that's exactly what January 6th was. And that's what all this election process wrangling is, because both sides now believe themselves justified in breaking the rules because the other guys broke the rules first, and also just a generic kind of they started it by being evil sentiment.
Right. And it's not just on the rise in terms of affecting more people. It's on the rise in terms of being more intense in the high intensity group, right? And so those are the people who are most active in trying to influence politicians and most active in sort of political discussions.
And it has been translated into proposed policy. At least we have a governor of Washington proposing this bill that would outlaw candidates questioning the results of elections, right? Like, this is a blatantly anti-First Amendment legislation in response to January 6th and the fallout from it.
I can hear our critics. We have some. Already accusing us of both sidesism, especially Catherine there, editor-in-chief of this entire publication. Christian.
My both sidesism is both sides.
But
just in case you wanted my subtle, nuanced take on that.
But the journalistic establishment, which I spend a lot of time in my life criticizing, will make the counterpoint. And Christian, I want you to address this specifically in terms of criticizing Catherine.
Do it.
Yeah, this is good.
Unfair position to put me in.
That there's an asymmetry. That, yes, Democrats question the election, but it's a couple people voting. It's not 147 members of Congress. Yes, there is a kind of sense of both sides, but we're talking a huge number of Republicans are actively taking the stick here. The last president, the by far most popular politician, and since Nick is not here, the absolutely he's going to win the nomination guy, if he wants it, if he lives, Republican candidate, says crazy nonsense, including on January 6th. I wish he was on Twitter, but his statement is just an argle bargle of insanities. Is there not an asymmetry, and doesn't Catherine's both sidesism fail to account for that, Christian?
Yeah, certainly it does. No, I think it's worth just like highlighting that there is like unparalleled villainy in Donald Trump in all this, right? Had he not, for months after the presidential election, gone about saying that it was stolen, encouraging all these maneuvers at the state level, and encouraging all these maneuvers in Congress to, you know, effectively overturn the election, none of this would have happened, and I think the temperature in the country would be a lot lower right now. But to defend Catherine's both-siderism, I mean, I think this is kind of how polarization and kind of, growing political extremism works, right? Is one side does something that's unprecedented and terrible, and then the other side uses that as license to do something even worse. And we haven't gotten to that point yet, but perhaps there will be an opportunity for Democrats to engage in that kind of behavior soon enough. And because we have elections all the time in this country, there certainly will be. So,
Christian, did you just both sides the is
I really
both
did,
sides
didn't I?
okay argument?
I would just add that a striking feature of the resistance, capital R, long may it wave, to Donald Trump on the Democratic Party approach to it, was the utter absence of people coming to the conclusion of maybe give that crazy person less power. That just was never part of the Democratic response to that, quite unlike the Democratic response to the abuses of executive power under Richard Nixon. And I think we will be living with that consequence for a while. And we'll just point out Dick Cheney, the new hero of the Democratic Party, his whole political career in many ways was an attempt, because he was in the Ford administration along with Donald Rumsfeld as youngins, was an attempt to restore power to the executive that he watched Democrats in Congress defrock aft in the wake of Richard Nixon. And I think Democrats were going in the right direction back then in certain respects in terms of limiting presidential power. And Cheney's restoration has been part of the bad story. And I wish it was more a part of the post-Trump story, but it's not. All right. Speaking of post-Trump, Peter, we have a new president, semi-new president, Joe Biden. Last week, in the wake of the Labor Department coming out with, I think, revised numbers of their jobs report, president called this a historic day for our economic recovery, a day in which the report showed that there are only 199,000 jobs created, the lowest number of monthly jobs created in a year. But that's also because the unemployment rate itself went down from 4.2% to 3.9%, which is kind of full employment territory. That is, if you don't count the 38.1% of the available labor force that's just kind of taking a knee right now. So, Peter, what the hell is going on? Is it a historic day for our economic recovery? I don't understand even what's going on with job numbers. So explain it.
So the partisan lines here are that the economy is either the greatest economy ever or it's the absolute worst economy ever, that it's truly, truly rotten. And I think the answer is that it's kind of neither and kind of both. This is actually an okay economy in some ways, a bad economy in others, but mostly it's an economy that is turbulent. It's a high friction economy. And a lot of the stress and argument about the state of it right now, some of it's just partisan, you know, mudslinging, but a lot of it is related to the fact that it is high friction and high stress, right? So it's, I think, worth just going over some of the kind of notable figures here that we've seen, some of the data we have on the economy, right? So we have the several months in 2021, we had the largest number of quits ever, hence the great resignation. We have people dropping out of the labor force, like you said. And I think a lot of the people dropping out of the labor force, you can look at that as a COVID phenomenon, not entirely. But there are a lot of what have been called excess retirements. And so that's retirements that you wouldn't expect in a normal year. And for the most part, that's just people who had planned to retire sometime in the next few years anyway, and have moved that start date up. And in many cases, because these are older people, they are more vulnerable, more susceptible to COVID. Plus, the economy is kind of wacky anyway, right? So why keep going for these last couple of years? And then some of that is also related to the fact that childcare is really difficult right now. And so that's pulled some women out of the workforce, because when childcare is difficult to come by, who ends up staying home to take care of the kids? It is in it is in the vast majority of cases, it's women. At the same time, there's some good news here. You see a lot of new business formation, in particular small businesses that have one employee and don't expect to hire. So, you know, this is people getting rich on Substack and Twitch, right? The Substack and Twitch, right? The creator economy it's not like a giant new sector that's going to overtake the entire American economy, but it's growing and people are figuring out different and new ways to work and to make money. We see, as you said, a low unemployment rate, and even the rate of people who are discouraged has come down, right? So that's a more expansive rate that doesn't count people who have dropped out of the labor force entirely, but people who would say, well, I don't know, maybe I'm looking for a job, but really, I'm discouraged, right? You also see higher wages, although there's some downside there, because that both causes and then is swamped by inflation, right? Higher wages mean higher prices, which sort of come back. There's a cycle there. Not all of the people who are quitting their jobs are quitting work entirely, right? So some of them are going to those Substack and Twitch jobs, right? That they're quitting their job for the insurance company, and they're going to go be a YouTube zillionaire. And in addition, there, you know, all of this also means that there is high demand for labor right now. So employers are looking for people, particularly people without college degrees. It's not too bad an economy for people with college degrees either, but that means that people who are less educated in the workforce right now have options, and there is something that is good about that, right? They can move from employer to employer, they can demand higher wages. And so again, this isn't the world's greatest economy. This is not the world's worst economy. This is an economy that is just going through a lot of stuff. Right, we had an earthquake and a tsunami and like a hailstorm all at once in March 2020, economically speaking, and now there's still like.
But also maybe like climatologically speaking.
Yeah, maybe. Also for real, right? It was the Thanos snap. It was the Thanos snap for the economy.
They
disappeared
minutes.
A whole bunch of jobs. They're trying to bring them online, and now it's really strange and weird. It's really strange and weird because when people come back after 5 years of being disappeared by a giant purple monster, it's very strange. That's all I got.
I'm sorry for America.
It's the only face I have.
A lot about urban policies, zonings, the things that are big city democratic, largely governance have been doing. Do you think we've seen enough of 22 months to state? I mean, there's been a lot of census numbers. New York and California losing population, Texas, Florida gaining it, even more so than usual. And in California's case, this is really the first time that's ever happened. Do we see enough to say that there's like a COVID acceleration of the kind of blue state exodus, or like did it expose a certain type of governance that people are realizing now? Like, holy cow, that's not how things should work.
Yeah, sure. I think COVID had two particular effects that got people to leave like major urban areas, right? So one is, you know, you don't have to go into the office for a lot of folks. And so therefore, why am I paying an incredible amount of rent to stay in, you know, New York or DC or wherever rents are high? Yeah, good there question. Well, because I love my colleagues so much and we are in the office. But and then the other one is that all the, you know, the things that justify those high rents, like not just offices, but like urban amenities, restaurants, concerts, whatever, those are also shut down for a long time and still labor under a lot of restrictions, mask mandates, vaccine mandates, what have you. And so a lot of people left because it wasn't worth living in an urban area, and they went to places where they didn't have those restrictions. They went to, you know, smaller metro areas, often in red states. And a lot of people who reorganizes their lives are not coming back. Also, one thing I do want to add to the decline in kind of blue state and blue city population numbers is a lot of that also has to do with just restrictions on like COVID era restrictions on immigration, right? Normally, the domestic outflow of people is made up for by new international, newcomers coming in who don't realize how terrible those places are. And that has been shut down. And so they haven't really been able to make up the numbers.
That also helps explain why employers are looking for labor, especially non-college educated labor, is because we don't have the immigration inflows that we need to keep up with the jobs.
Catherine, I saw this morning on the Drudge Report, so it's true. One out of every four Americans plans on quitting their job. So which one of us is going to do that this year in 2022?
I think each of us knows that answer in our hearts, and maybe we
know who's not here today.
Say it out loud all together. One, two, three, go. No.
One of us is missing, guys.
Yeah. This is it's like an Agatha Christie and then there were none situation. I mean, I don't know, but.
No, it's like the Star Trek episodes where everybody disappears slowly until there's only one character left and he's going mad.
She, that was Beverly Crusher. Yeah. Ooh, sorry.
There was also an episode like
that. Christian was very like, actually.
Yeah, man, I'm sorry.
There was also an episode like that in the original series.
Oh, okay. My God, nerds. So, yeah, I mean, I think like the weird situation that you just described and that Peter just described again in greater detail is exactly what that of course contributes to people thinking about leaving their jobs, right? If you say unemployment is low, people have savings, and also that it sort of seems fine both culturally and maybe as a matter of individual economics to not work for a while, and maybe even convenient or even money saving, depending on what your childcare situation is or your elder care situation is, that makes perfect sense to me. That a lot of people would be like, I don't know, maybe I'm going to leave my job. I will say my personal favorite jobs number, like political war thing, is the post that the White House put out a couple of days ago. It was on Instagram, but I think it showed up other places too, that was jobs created by president. And technically what this chart showed was job creation during the administrations of various presidents. But, you know, that's an ambiguous phrasing there. Like jobs created by Joe Biden personally was clearly meant to be the implication. And somebody has designed this chart for it to like just be like Joe Biden, 11 billion. Everybody else, none. Trump, negative none. And it's like, first of all, Reason has for decades made the point over and over and over. Hey, you know what? Actually, job creation is not something that the president just like manifests out of his magical executive like life force or whatever. In the same way that he cannot set gas prices, like presidents do have some influence over the economy, over job creation, in the sense that they can make spectacularly bad or presumably, in theory, spectacularly good policies, although we've never really seen that. But mostly the economy is doing its own thing. And like there's not some like wizard in a magical chair behind a magical desk that just like makes the jobs. And I hate to tell you, and the implication of this Joe Biden graphic, just the latest in a series of crappily misleading Joe Biden graphics, which, to be clear, followed a series of crappily misleading Donald Trump graphics. I mean, this is not something Biden pioneered, just shows how like utterly devoid of substance the actual debate about where these jobs are coming from and who's responsible for them and whether they're going to stay and what they mean in the context of these other employment numbers.
I just like the idea of Joe Biden going through Reason's stacks of resumes and hiring assistant editors personally.
Is that going to happen? That would be great. I need some help with HR, so cool.
All right, we're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, are you being held back by depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia? You can do something about that today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable to receive instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states and maybe even the District of Columbia. Yes, definitely. Betterhelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what Sonia Sotomayor needs with math, has helped more than 1 million people take control of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month. Other financial aid is also available, even though service is affordable to begin with. Go to the website betterhelp.com/roundtable. Describe your issues and your preferred technological methods of delivery, and they'll get you someone to talk to within 24 hours. And if you don't like that person, you could swap out him or her immediately. Please visit betterhelp.com today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder, please email your questions to us at roundtable@reason.com. Include your name, however you want it to be read, and your email. Right. All right. So this one comes from Sam Joyce, who says he really loves the podcast, but I wonder if you realize how large your blind spot is when it comes to rural and blue collar liberty lovers. Sorry. It's pretty galling to be sitting in a tractor and hear Peter and Nick explain that the entire ag industry is full of corporate welfare queens, while in the same breath, praising Elon Musk as some capitalist hero. I'm not suggesting that you replace Suderman and Nick with Ted Nugent and Mike Rowe. I'm going to insert myself here. I'm suggesting that right now. Are you kidding? The Nuge? But maybe you have a Reason staffer who grew up on a farm or whose kids skipped college and went to the oil field. Is there anyone who bought an exciting gun recently or killed an elk this year? Any thoughts on the new F-150? Is it fair the government forces us to use DEF in our diesel engines now? I love Stevenson as much as the next guy, but I fear that every hypothetical discussion about whether Iron Man could defeat Elon in the snow crash universe makes another liberty-minded truck driver just say screw it and write a check to a Trump PAC. Pretty good email, honestly. Farmer Sam Catherine. What's your name anyways?
What's happening
unclear,
right now?
just the mild Monday morning stroke. Does Farmer Sam have a point? Did he just catch you in the act of being a elitist?
I mean, I think Farmer Sam might have a point about the broader libertarian punditocracy, but, you know, this is a podcast of four people who are who they are. And I'm super interested in whether Iron Man can defeat Elon Musk in the Stevenson verse, and I will be talking about that until the day I die. And so, you know, on the one hand, I think, you know, this
so
is
Tony
actually...
Stark has those hand
stop
thrusters.
It. Stop it.
Shush your face. So, you know, on the one hand, I think that is, you know, should the libertarian movement's intellectuals pay more attention to the don't tread on me pickup truck libertarians? Probably, actually. Both as an, or, you know, as people who are doing organizing, people who are sort of doing work at the grassroots level of politics, should have better ways of talking with and interacting with and befriending that constituency of libertarianism. At the same time, Reason, I think, more broadly outside of this podcast, A, has a bunch of people like that, and B, produces content targeted at those audiences. We do gun stuff a lot. Like, our Reason TV crew went shooting at their retreat a couple of weeks back. I do not know what the pickup truck rate ownership is on staff, but it is not zero. I have ridden in our publisher Mike Alisi's maroon pickup truck. Yes, I described it by color because, again, I'm that bitch and that's who I'm always going to be. But, you know, Ron Bailey was raised on a farm and has written about that and how it strongly influenced his worldview. And in some ways, I think to say, hey, y'all aren't talking enough about pickup trucks, I'm going to go be a Trump supporter is like a weird, it's a weird threat. I guess it was a threat. You know, as a matter of strategy advice, I think that our farmer correspondent is making a decent point. But I also think that it's easy enough to stereotype us urban podcaster libertarians as well, and that he may have done so.
Christian, you have lived in the gritty heartland of Portland, Oregon. I presume that you've killed deer with your bare hands. Was it a culture shock for you to join in with the Beltway Cosmetarians?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Particularly as someone who doesn't watch Marvel movies or particularly care for Elon Musk. No, I was just thinking this morning as I was drinking my Miller Lite that how grateful I am that Reason rescued me from the salmon plant I used to work at. And so I don't know if that gives me blue collar credibility or whether
Is that a true story? It seems fishy to me.
Oh, jeez. All right.
No.
It's a true tale. All right.
You worked at a salmon plant?
These puns are just spawning more puns.
The Columbia River, the one there over by...
No, I was up in Alaska. Oh. Yeah, the real salmon country. So, But yeah, I don't know if that means I'm disavowing my roots or that gives me a little bit of blue collar credibility. So I'll leave that to the next listener email to decide.
Suderman, isn't it true that it's impossible to be an elitist out of touch with Charles Murray's Real America if you're from Florida?
First, I just want to say that Tony Stark's arc reactors would obviously destroy Elon Musk in a one-on-one fight because Elon Musk doesn't have
he's not
portable
a superhero
reactor technology. I mean, look, to answer the listener's question, I think this is a genuinely good question for us and one that we should be confronted with and one that we should think about. It is absolutely true that, like, I'm not a pickup driving farmer type, right? I mean, I have, you know, I went to college in something close to rural Kentucky, right? Surrounded by farmland. It's not like I've never experienced that part of the world. It's not like I grew up in a big city. I grew up, you know, in a sort of North Florida suburban space, but not like a big city in any ways. You know, and like these days I walk from my row house near the Capitol to drink at fancy cocktail
to
bars.
To your convenient neighborhood riot.
Yeah, right? Like that's who I am. And I think to some extent, it would be a mistake for me to try to pretend that I'm like a truck driving person who cares
to all the extents, like not just to some extent, but really to every extent.
Like has
that
like
would
deep
be a mistake.
Personal experience, I should say.
The vocabulary,
you know, with diesel
that.
Fuel prices.
No, he sounds like me talking about sports and also like music.
And so we should be paying attention to folks like that. But the thing I would say to this listener is that in some ways I would flip the question back on the listener. And I mean this in like an encouraging way. If libertarians from the heartland feel underrepresented in the media, then libertarians from the heartland should start their own podcasts and should be writing and should be submitting stuff to Reason and should be finding ways to get their voice out there. And the reason that it's more urban focused is because that's who submits things. That's who like comes and wants to work at magazines because farmers tend to want to work
on
farms. And so those
except
people,
Ron Bailey, who absolutely did not want to
work
on
right,
farms.
Except when they people who want to become farmers then don't become writers, podcasts, media figures, don't become pundits and activists. And I think we could use more people who have had experience doing both of those things and who sort of aren't necessarily located in one of a handful of big media cities. But the people who are located in those big media cities are not the right people to try and represent those experiences.
Matt, is now the moment that I should shore up my blue collar bona fides by saying that I was on the rifle team at Yale?
God, no. No.
Did you shoot targets from a sailboat?
The air rifle team. As the, I think, only non-college educated white person on this, so I'm the median Trump voter on this podcast.
It was a weird emphasis on white.
You know, whatever. although I'm overexposure to Camille Foster is leading me to not self-identify anymore. But I think that there's a broader, interesting media truth that is reflected in the question, and it's something that I kind of notice atmospherically in a lot of media coverage. There was a study that came out a couple of years ago. I believe it was in Politico. Jack Schaefer had some fingerprints on it, the great media writer, along with somebody else, talking about the shift in journalism jobs. And it was a pretty thoroughgoing survey. It wasn't just the usual, newspapers have lost jobs, and so therefore those jobs don't exist. It took in mind that there's, you know, whole media ecosystems online, niche and otherwise. And you could probably now, if you did it again, you would measure a lot of podcasting and Peter's mythical Substack gravy train there as well. But what it notices that over a 10-year period, and this is a crude rendering of it, but basically the number of journalism jobs that are based in just basically New York City went from one third to one half. And again, this is a crude rendering, but like it's an unbelievable tilting of things because you had newspapers regional newspapers especially just withering and dying and their newsrooms gutted. This also happening a lot to local TV news. They're shrinking and local radio is shrinking.
And that's why we need federal subsidies, right?
It is not why we need anything like a federal subsidy at all. What we need is more media creation. We need people to focus less on national politics. But part of this is that there's a demand side problem here. A lot of people, Ezra Klein had a column that's worth reading in the New York Times over the weekend that was sort of pinned at, you know, Democratic anxieties and activism about democracy dying in darkness and the usual stuff. I found like a lot of things that he writes on some levels both smart and super irritating. But the point that he was making is that people, and this is a lot of people have been making these points recently, is that the consumption of politics is essentially doom scrolling on a social media outlet about all the terrible things that are going on and kind of waving your hands and not actually engaging in any meaningful sense or even putting your finger on what is the thing that's going to protect the democracy with the capital letters. Like, what's the bill? What's in it? You know, it's like, what's in the Georgia election law that is so terrible and is so different from New York's election law? Well, then that suddenly in the specifics, it goes away in kind of a similar way. Just the way that people focus so much of their attention on what happens in Washington helps create that demand side for people who are spending all of their days talking about that, as opposed to looking in what's in this actual bill, whether it's in City Hall or state or whatever. People don't pay as much attention to local news and governance and politics, and as a result there's less of it in addition to the other factors that affect that. So but the one of the products is that you see this great dislocation between the people who are doing journalism and just vast swaths of the country, and the whole kind of like red state Appalachian Trail post-Trump exercise in the media, you know, shopping in diners for actual people who vote and think and talk differently. That didn't really last very long. It was kind of quickly shot down as cliched. But there's just something to that. The media creation class is coming from people who don't have anything like the life experiences of a whole bunch of the country. And the regional shift is such that, and this is something that I follow, is with the school opening debates, vast majority of the country has the schools in the country have just been open the whole time since fall of 2020. It's just that whenever we talk about it from a media standpoint, it's people like me who live in New York or people who live in Chicago or Los Angeles where things are a little bit different. And that gives a misleading overall impression of what's happening. And it is a real problem. And also from the perspective, I think, of media organization, news organizations, an incredible opportunity. That means there's going to be a lot of people who are undervalued by the market, who live in places and come from these cultures, who can be part of a news team. So I see this as a wonderful reminder, Farmer Sam, that we got people out there. And if you are out there listening and feel like you've been talked about or condescended or whatever, but you're doing the journalism and you live in the place that isn't where we do the journalism and live in the place, send an email immediately to Catherine right now. Just pile up her inbox right now. Catherine, am I right?
Or you could use our submissions process and submit a pitch to submissions@reason.com.
Actually, that's right.
But honestly, send me an email, man. KMW@reason.com. I'm always happy to hear from y'all.
There we go. All right. Enough of my speechifying. Sorry for the length. Let's go to our end of podcast. What we have been consuming in the cultural spheres. Peter, do you want to start with whatever first-person shooter you're playing this weekend?
So I'm actually not going to talk about playing Halo Infinite. Instead, I'm going to talk about Jonathan Franzen's new novel, Crossroads. I finished this after a couple of months. The novel has been out since the fall of last year. But this is another novel by the guy behind Freedom, Purity, The Corrections. It's about a Midwestern family, which is often a subject of his fiction. The father is an ex-Mennonite pastor. The wife is sort of a dutiful a dutiful wife who has a dark past and is probably the most interesting character in the book. And then there's a bunch of kids. And it is just so engagingly written with such real characters who have such complex inner lives, not just complex, but contradictory, right? They seem like real people because they have thoughts that don't quite make logical sense, right? And yet somehow or another, they add up in the way that all people sort of seem to contain multitudes, right? And so like all of his novels, it's deeply personal and idiosyncratic. It's built around a series of linked novellas, each one told from the perspective of a different character in the family. And each one of those stories is about making choices and trying to take control of your life when it seems to be going off of the rails. And it's about how hard that is because so much in life seems to be chosen for you or directed for you by others, by society, and even more than that, by parents and by family. And so he is wrestling with the idea of choice and unchosen bonds. And he's not a libertarian or anything close. I mean, like, if you know anything about his politics, he's sort of an annoying lefty, except... that he shares something with libertarians, which is that he believes that individual choice and wrestling with how and whether you can take control of your own life is sort of at the core of the human experience. And he's just so good at looking at that and at figuring out ways to express that dramatically. Highly recommend Jonathan Franzen's new novel, Crossroads.
Nice. Christian, what have you been consuming?
Last week I went to go to the 9:30 Club here in DC for the first time to see the band Clutch, which is a Maryland rock and roll band. My favorite band, Farmer Sam would probably like them a lot. And if you can get past the ridiculous COVID security state that is any concert venue here in DC, it was an incredible time. Those guys, this was like the 30th year anniversary of their first album, and they still had an old man like myself pushing other people in the mosh pit. So it's a good time.
What was the COVID security situation like?
Oh my goodness. So you got to show your vaccine proof. You got to have both shots. Then you get a stamp on one hand. And then of course you got to show your ID. So you get a stamp on the other hand. And then, so you have to wear your mask in the venue the whole time. And they actually had like staff, like expeditions into the mosh pit to grab people who weren't wearing their masks.
Wait,
and
the mosh
them
pit
out.
People were wearing their masks.
Yeah, well, so the ones who weren't had to get the fuck out
God.
Of there, right? Sorry, I don't know if I can say that.
Dear
on the podcast.
God.
But, it's not a family-friendly podcast. You're fine.
Okay. So that's
that this dystopia that you paint is horrific. Catherine, what have you been consuming?
So I read So Long, See You Tomorrow by William Maxwell. This is one of those books that you're supposed to have read. Like it shows up on lists of the 100 great novels of the 20th century. As Peter was describing the Jonathan Franzen book, I was like, oh, so actually this is sort of, it's a series of linked stories that were published originally in The New Yorker. And it's set in the middle of America. It's about wrestling with the idea of choice and unchosen bonds and the question of how you can take control of your life. And
how do you do that, Catherine?
It's
did you learn?
Because
the Franzen novel doesn't tell you at the end.
So I got to tell you, this William Maxwell novel also very much doesn't tell you at the end. I don't think I actually liked this book, but it was, you know, a sort of purposeful choice to read one of these, you know, books that people say you're supposed to have read. It is set in the 20s. It was published in the 80s. And it's also basically the podcast Serial. In that the story is a man who is William Maxwell, essentially, who has fled his rural Illinois hometown to live in the big city. William Maxwell was the short story editor for The New Yorker for a very long time. And he remembers a murder that occurred in his hometown. And he remembers a friendship he had with a boy who was tangentially involved in this murder and how he maybe didn't do right by the boy. And so he sort of goes back to try and figure out what really happened in this, what was essentially a kind of adultery-driven murder. And I developed a conspiracy theory about this book, which may or may not be accurate, which is that when people are fiction editors of The New Yorker, a lot of people have good reason to suck up to you and tell you that your novel is really, really good. And maybe everyone kind of drank their own Kool-Aid, and there was a kind of thing where everyone just said this book was good because they liked William Maxwell, and every person in the entire literary mid-20th century New York was friends with him. And then somehow it became part of the American novelistic canon, but it's maybe not actually that good. Or maybe I'm an uncultured rube who doesn't appreciate art when I see it. Definitely one of those two things. But if you want a novel about the tension between the rural understanding of personal freedom and choice and what that looks like when viewed later in life from an urban cosmopolitan vantage point, maybe this novel is for you.
So my consumption during my COVID quarantine over Christmas, that was super fun. I finally finished something I might have referenced once before or even twice on this podcast. The 8-part, 17.5-hour documentary called New York, a documentary film by Rick Burns, the younger brother, I believe, of Ken Burns. The first 5 episodes came out in 1999, and then the which took from 1609 to 1931, and then there are 2 more covering the 20th century that came out just after September 11th on September 30th and October 1st of 2001, as I'm looking at the Wikipedia page right now. And then the another one came out in 2003 that incorporated the World Trade Center. It was all about that. I finally finished it all. It's great. It is great. Just a magisterial look at the, especially kind of the commercial culture that's baked into New York, and how that leads to this kind of gruff tolerance. And my big surprise in finally landing the plane on this one was the episode, was episode number 7, which took you from 1945 to 2000, which you really should have cut in half in the mid 60s, because 2/3 of it is ultimately about Robert Moses and how he turned dark. He's the power broker from the Robert Caro book. And it's really, and sadly, I was hoping to put this off. It's the book that is on more bookshelves and is not read than more than any other book, aside from maybe the Bible. I'm going to have to read it now because it was absolutely captivating on that front. The documentary has a series of historians reading into the camera. And actually, one of the unsung wonderfulnesses about it is that the historians become characters after a while, each with their own phenomenal accent. Robert Caro has the greatest accent you've ever heard. I can't exactly place it, but it's very sort of New York. It becomes charming in its own way. Definitely leans a bit to the left, I would say. It hates the automobile with a white hot passion, but ultimately is just a beautiful look. And what was I found myself just startled to the extent, I'm just going to turn me to Jim Epstein ultimately, because he actually has read all the books and seen all the documentaries. But the amount of physical dislocation and terrible life-altering policies that emanated, and they don't really draw these lines directly in an accusatory way, but emanated from a combination of the New Deal and then a guy with sort of ruthless power ambitions to reshape the world like an engineer, and leading to you know, all kinds of craziness and urban renewal and all of that. It's just it's breathtaking in its scope to watch that, and like the sense of libertarian outrage that bubbled up in my chest. I'm afraid that if I finally do read this 9,000 word book or 9,000 page book, The Power Broker, I'm actually going to finally grow up and become a libertarian. So maybe I need to put it off before I go completely crazy with it. But it's great. New York, documentary film, Rick Burns. It's on PBS, Amazon, kind of combination or whatever. But I recommend it very highly. All right, that's all the Matt Welch monologuing that we ever need to hear again. Thank you for listening to the Reason Roundtable podcast. Look at all of our stuff in the podcast realm, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forum debate series with Gene Epstein. Just go to reason.com/podcasts. And as ever, we are a 501c3. Love to get your sweet donations to keep us running and do more stuff, including do more podcasts, which we're working on right now. Go to reason.com/donate. There's even sort of a monthly situation in addition to the subscription to the magazine. But go there, check it out, help us out. We love you. Goodbye.